From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the latest from day one of the Mackinac Policy Conference.
For, you know, these 3 days becomes kind of this melting pot of the state's leaders.
Why have Midwestern schools turned away from Midwestern history?
Unless you understand your history, you're in a bad position to make policy for the future.
A soccer dad arrested for shoving and throwing a cup at a 16-year-old referee. Are we seeing more of this?
A picture can tell 1,000 words, while a video can probably tell 1,000,000 words, to where, you know, certainly some of these incidents are now being captured on a camera phone.
Lake Michigan's rising water levels add up to shrinking beaches.
The water is coming up, and it just is going up over the sand as well as eroding the sand.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. In places like the South or New England, universities and professors are dedicated to studying regional histories. But in the Midwest, not so much. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, why Midwestern history's declined, its cultural importance, and the push to revive it. But first, this is day one of the annual Mackinac Policy Conference put on by the Detroit Regional Chamber. Michigan's movers and shakers and many reporters have converged on Mackinac Island. That includes our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta with us now from the Grand Hotel. Good to have you join us.
Hello, Cindy.
Hello.
Hey, for the great majority of people who will never attend this policy conference, Zoe, tell us what happens during these 3 days. And, you know, is it more than just 3 days of schmoozing and cocktails?
Yeah, well, there's sort of what happens, you know, above surface and what happens below surface. It's, as you say, 3 days of sessions where speakers, you know, like Governor Snyder, like Mayor Mike Duggan, influential business leaders, some thought leaders. There's a futurist in residence who will be here talking about, I'm assuming, the future. But then what other folks...
Is that a prediction?
That is my prediction. What's really happening, though, is, as you say, Cindy, you know, there's anywhere between about 1,600 folks, business leaders, politicians, entrepreneurs, philanthropists who get here on the island and meet, and there, you know, are negotiations about things, there's conversations, and so it, for, you know, these 3 days becomes kind of this melting pot of the state's leaders.
And although if they were going to pass out, you know, really honest T-shirts, they would read, you know, I'm kind of a big deal.
I was just going to say I'm kind of a big deal. and boy, do a lot of folks here think that.
They either are or they want to be. It's why they're here.
And Rick, the conference is put on, as we know, by the Detroit Regional Chamber. And its CEO, Sandy Baru, has been real consistent saying he wants his conference to matter to the entire state and not be Detroit-centric. When you think of what's going to be talked about over these 3 days, is that the case?
Well, no and yes, in this particular respect, that it will be Detroit-centric, but the fact is the region is so important to the rest of the state that it can't help but be of statewide interest. And I think the discussions going on about the Detroit Public Schools bailout are a classic example of exactly that.
And let's start with there, because that's how the morning started, with what we understand was a pretty vigorous discussion or debate on DPS funding. Zoe, who was there?
Yeah, it was a heated debate, and basically what you saw is folks from kind of, you know, both sides.
It was Dan Quisenberry with the charter schools and John Ricolta, basically on behalf of the Detroit Regional Chamber, arguing, you know, their respective sides on the charter issue, which is just central to, you know, whether or not this deal is going to get done.
Exactly, and we've got some news today, you know, part of why the House Republicans aren't here on this conference, with just some senators, is because there was hope that there might be some kind of deal on the financial crisis in DPS happening in Lansing. And Rick, you've got a little bit of news on that, no?
Well, it seems the House has asked for the return of the bills that that they adopted last month, and they're going to go back to work on them maybe today, maybe tomorrow, in hopes of crafting something. The only thing is the architects of the last bipartisan deal have basically been shut out of the discussions. And so we may be looking at another Republican-only version of this plan, which is going to be a big problem up here on the island, because the Detroit Regional Chamber, the, you know, political leaders from Detroit are saying that you need buy-in from the city, and the central issue is this commission that would oversee the opening and the closing of schools in the city based on their performance.
And that's why we saw, you know, this heated exchange this morning between folks who feel really, really passionate about the issue but are on very, very different sides.
What were some of the things you heard that really stuck in your mind in these passionate comments?
Really nothing new that you know, this has been the argument all along, but there are advocates who are saying that something needs to be done to control the proliferation of charter schools, especially underperforming charter schools in the city. And the charter advocates are saying we want the same rules applied to the charters and to the traditional public schools, and no matter, you know, how you frame it, that a commission is going to favor the traditional public schools over the charters in most instances. Now, what they're talking about wouldn't apply to high-performing charters and high-performing traditional public schools, for that matter, but the charter school operators, at least some of them, are saying that's not enough.
The beginning of the annual Mackinac Policy Conference opening with some fireworks over the future of Detroit Public Schools. Checking in with Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team, checking in from the Grand Hotel. Thank you so much to both of you.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Cindy.
When it comes to taking out frustrations on a referee, it certainly seems to be a case of game on. Recently, a 41-year-old soccer dad was arrested and stands accused of shoving and throwing a cup at a 16-year-old referee after that ref called a foul on a player during a youth league match in Northfield Township. This past February, a hockey mom got into a fight with a ref after her son was checked into the boards during a game in Troy. And in 2014, a soccer ref in Livonia died after he was punched by an adult player angered after getting a red card. That player pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter and got a 15-year prison sentence. Let's talk about these assaults on sports officials as we welcome Mark Ewell. He's assistant director of the Michigan High School Athletic Association and the former chair of the board of directors of the National Association of Sports Officials. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Boy, that was just a long litany of awful behavior, which I had absolutely no problem finding very, very quickly, these attacks on referees. Is this a growing problem, or are we just hearing more about it in this digital age we live in?
I think the digital age certainly is bringing more of these issues and unfortunate incidents to light. You go back and read some news clippings from the 1910s and 1920s and the statement of kill the umpire, you know, you'd often see those. So there's always kind of been that somewhat uneasy relationship between coaches and officials, or fans and spectators and officials, to where we've had these isolated cases, I think, over a long period of time. But now, given the internet, you know, the old saying of a picture can tell 1,000 words, well, a video can probably tell 1,000,000 words, to where, you know, certainly some of these incidents are now being captured on a camera phone. And thankfully for the officiating business, they're now going viral. So hopefully it's sending a message that referees and umpires and judges and officials are human beings. And while there may be things that happen during a game that people may disagree with or even think that the official got the play or the situation wrong, it doesn't need to lead to physical violence. And unfortunately, we're seeing more and more of that all the way from the adult recreation leagues down to the youth and little league levels as well. Thankfully, yet at the school level, we're not seeing many of these types of incidents at all, just because our people are subject to a much higher standard in terms of their personal behavior toward the officials. We have some pretty strict penalties that are in place whenever someone is ejected from a game, and then we have very stiff penalties if there ever would be physical contact between one of the game participants and the officials. The areas of sport that are really trying to get their arms around this are those recreational or those youth programs, to where a lot of times they're counting on volunteer coaches. There is no oversight. There is no accountability to that athletic director, that principal. That's really where things almost seem to be heading, as if this is the wild, wild west.
Mark, what are your thoughts about the news coverage of these assaults? I mean, what's it do in the sense of trying to recruit new referees?
It truly is a double-edged sword, to where, on, you know, as you said, in the one breath, bringing more attention and focus to this issue is hopefully going to get people, when they're at their next game or their next event, to maybe mind their P's and Q's a little bit better. But yet on the other side of that coin, where we go out and we try and attract people to officiating, that you get that person that's maybe a former athlete or someone that has a real passion or love for athletics and says, well, you know, I'd like to get a little bit more involved. Maybe I want to become a referee. And, you know, almost now on a weekly basis, every time you turn around, there's some report of some incident from some place in the country or even the world at large of violence involving a referee. And maybe that potential junior high basketball referee is now, we've lost them to where they've gotten turned off and they're thinking to themselves, well, gosh, maybe this hobby is just too dangerous.
Mark, according to a report on MLive, 20 states now have laws on the books that actually define an assault on a sports official as a specific crime. And after that tragedy in 2014, the death of soccer referee John Benowitz in Livonia, there has been a push to have Michigan join the ranks. So can you tell us what's the status of this effort?
Currently, the bill is in committee. Our biggest challenge, even at the school level, instead of focusing on, you know, legislation to try and fix this, we're working really hard to try and change the culture a little bit. The old days of, you know, people plunking down their money and going to watch the high school team play and, you know, thinking that that $5 ticket that got them in the door also gives them free rein to yell and scream and treat that person out there refereeing the game is almost a subhuman. Need to get back to having respect really be the focus, to where we expect our kids to respect the opponent. We expect our coaches to respect their opposing coach as well as the game officials. And hopefully those sitting in the stands can have that level of respect where, again, there may be things that happen during the game you disagree with or think they got wrong. But there's a way to disagree without being just completely disrespectful and turning the atmosphere somewhat violent. So we're really choosing to put our focus on improving the working conditions for officials, trying to improve that culture of competitive sports right now, rather than sitting back and thinking that you know, some law making its way through our legislature is automatically going to fix everything.
Well, a strong message to parents and fans and players. Mark Ewell is the assistant director of the Michigan High School Athletic Association, as well as the former chair of the board of directors of the National Association of Sports Officials. Mark, thanks so much.
Great to be with you. Thanks again.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's an all-out deep dive into Midwestern history. Today, the Hauenstein Center at Grand Valley State University is hosting the second Midwestern History Conference. The goal? To get more attention to Midwest history among history professionals and everyone else for that matter. Let's talk about getting more respect for Midwestern history. John Locke is here with us now. He's a professor of political science and history at the University of South Dakota, and he's president of the Midwestern History Association. Good to have you with us, John.
Well, thank you, Cindy. I appreciate the warm welcome that Michigan always gives for this conference.
We like this conference. And I want to start with this, the fact that you wrote a book talking about the disappearance of Midwestern history, and you are the perfect person to ask. What happened to it? I mean, the title of this week's conference is Finding the Lost Region. Are we lost here in the Midwest?
Well, a couple of years ago, I wrote a book, as you mentioned, entitled The Lost Region. And the point of that book was to describe what happened to the old field of Midwestern history, which up until about mid-20th century, was a very robust field. And it had lots of practitioners, and there were a lot of books, including Pulitzer Prize-winning books written about the region. And unfortunately, in the years after World War II, the field went into steep decline. So you really don't even see advertisements anymore for positions in Midwestern history. You don't see people marketing themselves as Midwestern historians. There wasn't even a Midwestern History Association until a year or so ago, and there wasn't even a journal focused on the Midwest until a year or two ago. And that's when a few of us got together and decided that this has gone on long enough and we need to take a stand and try and revive the field. And a very big part of that effort has been this annual conference at the Hauenstein Center at Grand Valley State.
Well, what happened in that, let's say, 60-some years since the end of World War II as we moved through? Why did the field of Midwestern history become anything but robust?
Well, I think there are a number of factors. I think after World War II, there was a great deal of focus on internationalism and being cosmopolitan and the old Midwestern isolationism of the pre-World War II years was kind of delegitimized. And I think there was a great deal of focus in academia on studying the broader world. And, you know, that's obviously a very noble endeavor, and that's something we want to promote. But it came at the cost of a lot of focus on this region. And I think there was also kind of a failure of leadership by Midwestern universities. Unlike universities in other parts of the country, like the West or New England or the South, the Midwestern universities just haven't done a very good job of promoting studies of their region, because I think there is a viewpoint out there that the region doesn't have much of a history. It's kind of a boring history. It's not exciting like Western history and romantic like the West. And, you know, it doesn't have these compelling, dramatic storylines like Southern history. And so, unfortunately, the universities in the region stopped studying the region. And, you know, here's a good example of how bad it's become. At the University of Georgia, there are about 10 people who study the history of Georgia and the South. But at the University of Minnesota, just to pick on them to make the point, there is not one person who teaches the history of the Midwest or Minnesota. You know, that's a major failure of leadership. And I think that's why some people have been pretty receptive to this effort to get people thinking about our region again and writing about it again. So we're very happy with the early returns.
Now, here's a question, and you're the best person for us to ask, because there is some debate, depending upon whom you ask, in certain states. What does the Midwestern History Association define as the Midwest?
Well, we haven't taken an official stand, but our unofficial point of view is that the old census definition of the 12 states of the Midwest is what we focus on. And those states are Ohio, obviously that sort of begins the Midwest when you cross the Ohio River past Pittsburgh, and then into Michigan and Indiana and Illinois and Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, of course, as everyone agrees, is Midwestern. And then it gets a little bit trickier, because the southern half of Missouri is heavily southern, and the northern half of Missouri is, you know, heavily Iowa-oriented. So about the northern half of Missouri. And then on the plain states, the eastern halves of those states, so the Dakotas, Nebraska, and Kansas, are very much Midwestern and Midwestern-oriented and very much agricultural-oriented. But once you get past the 100th meridian or so, you get out into the plains and it gets drier and it becomes more Western, and you know, the topography changes. And that's really kind of where the Midwest ends.
And let me ask you this as well. Why is it that the Midwest is considered America's most common ground?
Well, the Midwest is very unique in the sense that it became a meeting place of lots of different social groups. It became a crossroads of various migration streams. And so you get a heavy influx of Yankees, you get a heavy influx of Southerners, you get a heavy influx of people from the middle colonies, Pennsylvania, et cetera. And on top of that, you get this big influx of foreign-born people, especially Germans, Dutch, of course, here in Grand Rapids, a lot of Norwegians and Swedes and Scandinavians that are particularly prominent in Wisconsin, Minnesota, the Dakotas, but obviously in northern Michigan, too. I mean, you have a big northern Michigan is probably the heartland of Finnish immigrants to the United States. So you get a real conglomeration of peoples in the Midwest, which you don't have in other places. I mean, New England is very heavily Puritan culture. Of course, the South has its own very unique and peculiar culture, as we called it back in the day. And the Midwest, I think, has this mixture of people, and I think that's given rise to a very strong civic culture and greater degrees of tolerance and openness and civic-mindedness here than perhaps in other regions.
You can find out more about the work of the Midwestern History Association by going to their website, which is MidwesternHistory.com. John Locke is president of the Midwestern History Association. Love talking history, and thank you so much for spending some time with us on Stateside, John.
Thanks, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you follow Michigan music, you've probably heard of the Accidentals, a trio of young musicians who entered the indie folk scene in 2013, one of Billboard magazine's top seven breakout bands of South by Southwest in 2015. Today, they released their new EP called Parking Lot. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia talked with the Accidentals about their new music, Michigan, and their next venture.
It's been great anticipating an answer. But all I've got is a wall of black ice.
The Accidentals are Savannah Beist, Katie Larson, and Michael Dawes. Welcome, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Michael, you're the newest member of the band. How did you meet Katie and Savannah?
So I met the girls up at a festival called Blissfest up in Harbor Springs in 2013. And we all kind of became friends because we were all around the same age and we're all playing music. And then in 2014, they found out that I played the drums, and they had me sit in on a few shows, and that kind of turned into joining the band.
Michael's actually a multi-instrumentalist. He plays bass, electric guitar, acoustic guitar. He sings, writes his own songs, and he was also attending Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee for audio technology when we first met. So, of course, we stole him away and asked him to join us on the road because somebody with that many skills and talents is somebody well needed in a band like this. We have multiple things going on all the time. Katie has switch instruments like every song. So it's really cool to have somebody who can kind of keep up with that pace. And Michael's pretty much the perfect addition for that.
We lay down in the grass in a nest of sleeping bags.
The Accidentals recently released the single called Michigan and Again. It's a love letter to the state, and it all started as part of a fundraising campaign to get to the West Coast. The members asked fans to donate, and for a certain amount of money, the donor could suggest a song topic.
This guy named Mark from Ludington got on, and he's like, why don't you guys write a song about Michigan? I was like, wow, why haven't we done that yet?
Great state, what state am I in? Compass roses bloom again. Home of the water, Canada's daughter, cradled in a crescent moon grin. Michigan and again and again and again and again.
And when I sat down to do it, I was like, wait, Michigan, this is why we haven't done it yet. There is so much to say. How am I going to be able to, like, sum it all up in one song? I went kind of back into this journal. I do a lot of journaling on the road. I opened it up and I started reading about all these other states and how I kind of described, like, what it's like to drive along a mountain ridge. And all these oceans and lakes and, like, deserts and just being in different kind of climates in, like, a flash of a second, watching life kind of morph around you. And then one thing I kind of felt from that was that there's nothing quite like coming back to Michigan. There's no other place that's completely surrounded by fresh water. Like, the woods are really beautiful, and I feel like a lot of those lines are autobiographical, where it's talking about how your family kind of waits for that, and not just your immediate family, but like the family that Michigan has created for us to come home to. They're all waiting. So I feel like that's kind of where the song came from. That it really is a love letter in that way. It's a thank you to all the support we've received. It's a thank you to all the people who've kind of accepted us as part of the Michigan family.
Looking down to the high five, breezing ground to hear the sound of a heavy sigh. Home is where you left your heart behind. Even fortified fossils dissolve over time. When I came home, I went down to the lake. My dad told me he counts up the days. And when I packed my bags, coffee stains of jet lag, there were conifers lining the driveway. Stay.
The Accidentals' last album called Bittersweet came out in 2013 when Savannah and Katie were still in high school. In 2015, they played 230 shows across the country and learned a lot about the business along the way. Plus, being under 21 posed an interesting challenge for the members, which they write about in their song Parking Lot.
And one thing that happened when we started touring these bigger cities on the West Coast is that they have really strict age policies in the venues, which is not something that we're used to growing up in Michigan. Like, Savannah and I got our start playing, like, duo shows in, like, every place that sells alcohol. Like, you know, breweries gave us huge support, the wineries, everything. We came to some of these venues on our tours where they would find out that we were minors, and they were not happy about it. And so sometimes we'd get kicked out, and we'd have to wait in the parking lot as soon as we're done sound checking, and we go in, play our show, and then immediately have to be escorted out. Like, we can't sell merch, we can't talk to anyone. It's like very much in and out.
She's got an icy disposition. She looked back and told me that she was smoking carbon black. I said, I'll see you in the green room.
Parking Lot is also kind of a testament to what this album is all about. This year was really the breaking out transition year for us, 2015 into 2016, and I think the whole idea was to start releasing music on a regular basis, to get out of that parking lot that we've kind of been sitting in for a while, and so that's really what this EP is. It's self-produced. We went in and recorded it in Texas. It's going to be pretty much a thank you present to all the fans who've supported us in the past couple of years and waited on this music.
Yeah, we had a lot of ideas going into this album and a lot of different ways of how to approach it, since this release is the first release we put out in 3 years. So we really wanted to figure out a way to present how we've evolved, especially since we've had Michael with us for about 2 years now. It's kind of changed the way we write songs. And so we really wanted to capture a live feeling. And so we had the opportunity to work with tons of great producers, you know, since we started, and we've learned a lot, and there's a lot that goes into producing a song, and finding a way to strike the balance of covering yourself and kind of making the song the best that it can be, and adding elements that you can't do live, but also not overproducing the song. And yeah. So that's one thing that we tried to work on in the studio, and really just kind of capturing exactly where we are in the moment right now.
Under new management based out of Nashville. So what's next?
Well, we're in talks with a couple of different labels right now. We're planning on touring full-time until October, and then we're going to see if we can start recording another album in that time. Yeah, we're just excited for all the stuff going on. We've recently been endorsed by Shure Microphones as well as Boss Roland Company.
Yeah, so we're going to spend some time rehearsing in the winter, and we're going to find really cool ways to incorporate some new toys into our set and some pedals and
new instruments.
And, we've got 40 unreleased songs, so we're kind of sitting on that and excited to, you know, throw together a really cool show for tour probably in 2017, but
yeah, I think the band is all about constant growth and constant experimentation of genres. We're always trying new stuff. And so I think we're just going to keep doing that for the next couple of years and see what happens. Get these albums out and release music on a more consistent basis and stay true to our roots.
Savannah Beist, Katie Larson, and Michael Dawes are The Accidentals. Their new EP is called Parking Lot, and it's out today. Thanks for talking with me, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And can you send us out with a song?
Yeah, let's go ahead and play Epitaphs.
He's got too much pride, Lord, if you can see it with his navy eyes. Life is never painted in the black and white, ooh, with the gray in between. It's got too much light, sun will come to tremble in the bruise of night. Moon that builds up for the tangerine and broken stains of morning sky. And scattered on the birch tree lives of the mockingbirds who disagree on everything that flits to mind. What's lost and what's just hard to find. I'm blaring on the silver box of those who are only there to talk. So I will find a better way to speak. From a silver can, staring from a bed into a lava lamp that bubbles up her thoughts about money and time, things that share a problematic love life that we cut yourself up with a butter knife just when it hits your prime. And scattered on the dirty streets of the broken souls who disagree and beg for what you're offering, and all the while we're promising the rain will fall on fertile ground.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 3 years ago, water levels in Lake Michigan and Lake Huron were at record lows, and water levels for the other Great Lakes were well before average. What a difference 36 months can make. This year, Lake Michigan could be at a near record high. The lake has risen 4 feet since the all-time low in January 2013. What's that mean for communities along the Lake Michigan shore? Kathleen Torreson is the president of Torreson Marine in Muskegon. Her family's business dates back to 1965. She's worked there for most of her life. Kathleen, how has the high water level affected business at the marina?
Well, overall, the high water level is great for boating in the Great Lakes because it allows our customers and the people using the water a lot more flexibility in where they're going and what they're using. On the other side of the coin, high water tends to be really, really tough on fixed objects like seawalls and fixed docks and things like that, things that were built when water levels were at other depths. And as the water comes up and up, they become more prone to damage and erosion, kind of like they've been seeing along the beaches.
What does that look like then as you walk along a beach? Give us a sense of what the result of that damage to fixed objects looks like.
Well, there was a very large storm that blew through the area here at the very end of December, and the wind came out of a very different direction than it normally does at very high velocities of 60 to 70 miles an hour. The end result was when the sun came up the next day, large sections of riprap and other items that were along one of the roadways here had been all washed away. We lost, well, not completely lost, but had a seawall where that direction of wind and waves washed out an area of seawall that had been there for decades. And if the water were lower, the waves would not have been able to come up over the top of the seawall like they did and wash out the dirt and fill behind it.
Hmm. And for people who have homes and live along the Lake Michigan shore, what kind of impact are people seeing?
A lot less beach than they had, especially a couple of years ago. The water is coming up and it just is going up over the sand as well as eroding the sand when the weather turns bad.
I know you've spent a lot of your life, you know, at Torreson Marine and knowing Lake Michigan. You must have seen fluctuations over the years.
Absolutely. I've seen many, many fluctuations. I can remember the last all-time high, which was, I believe, the early 80s. And I've also, you know, seen it go to the lows where we're constantly having to do dredging to keep our slips and our marina usable for our customers. In fact, a couple years ago, I did an interview for a news station standing in one of our slips because the water was so low that it was just, I was standing on a sandbar.
What a difference. Just really a very short period of time. Overall, for you and your business, is the high water level better for your business?
In some ways, it is because, like I said, we don't have the expense of having to do the dredging and that type of maintenance to keep the water deep enough for some of our we specialize in sailboats, so we have some pretty large boats that come in that are pretty deep, and we need to keep everything dredged out. On the flip side of the coin, when the weather turns bad and the water's high and the fixed structures start taking damage, all of a sudden, that money we're saving from not having to dredge, we're having to spend to put things back together that got beat up by the high water, because water is a very powerful thing.
Is what's happening now different from the kind of fluctuations you've seen in the past, Kathleen?
I have never seen this rapid of a change. I've seen lots of changes. I'd have to say that I've seen this rapid of a change, but not this large of a rapid change. And when I say rapid, this rapid of a change, if the weather comes through the right way and the moon's the right way, you can watch the water go up 9 to 12 inches over the course of a day. However, to have the 4-foot difference over the course of less than 2 years, that I have never seen before.
Are you worried about it?
No, because it's always in cycle and it is always changing. And it's not a big concern. Whatever Mother Nature presents to us, that's what we work with.
Because that's what you do when you live along a lake in Michigan, exactly. Right?
Exactly. Have to be flexible or we wouldn't be here.
Kathleen Torreson is president of Torreson Marine in Muskegon. It was really great talking with you, Kathleen. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And tomorrow we'll find out just why the lake levels are so high this year and whether it's all part of normal patterns or something that requires long-term adjustments. When you're a parent, trying to figure out the rules of the playbook and do the best job possible for your kids can be pretty overwhelming. Heather Shoemaker wants to offer some reassuring advice. Sometimes you have to trust your gut. Heather's a national speaker on parenting and early childhood issues. Her latest book is titled, It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. She joins us now from the Upper Peninsula. Your first book was It's Okay Not to Share. Where does this new book pick up?
Yeah, this book picks up where the other one left off, so it continues to meet the needs of people with preschool age kids, but it goes into the kindergarten and early elementary school years as well.
And explain this philosophy of the renegade rules. What does that mean?
Well, I think it's about questioning things that we've always taken for granted. Some of these parenting adages such as don't talk to strangers, do your homework, safety first, all these things we've heard all our lives. And the renegade part is I tip those upside down and say, from a child development point of view, it makes sense to do the opposite.
And why is that?
Well, pick your topic. For example, with don't talk to strangers, that's something we've all heard all our lives. But what we're finding is that it doesn't keep kids safe. It's not a message that works. And instead, it's more helpful to have kids learn and gain that kind of street smart practice of interacting with all kinds of people. Unfortunately, of course, it's the friends, family, and acquaintances, people that children already know, who are most likely to harm a child. So the stranger advice doesn't help in that way, and it's most likely the strangers who are going to help a child, help find a lost child or a scared child or give a hurt child some help.
So I can see how you want to kind of upend some of these things that people just always have taken as pretty much as gospel.
Yes, indeed.
There's a pretty widespread image of parenting in 2016, it's no secret, as being super concerned about our kids' safety and super involved in everything they do from school to athletics to dance and other activities. What is that micromanaging or that, if you will, helicopter parenting do to our kids and to us?
Yes, well, it makes us both stressed on the parent side and the child side, and it sort of gets in the way of the children developing some of the essential life skills that they need, which includes being able to deal with a range of their emotions and cope with them. Because some of the over-sheltering that you talked about is actually emotional sheltering and social interaction sheltering, whether it's strangers or even playdates setting up things with kids. So sometimes we're not just worried about the physical risks kids take, like running too fast on concrete when we shout, be careful, after them. But it's also these social and emotional risks.
Well, because we don't want them to be hurt.
Yes, and it's a good instinct. We want to prevent pain. But I think what we need to understand is that what helps the kids most is giving them the skills they need to cope with life, not to over-shelter them from life itself.
You challenge us in your book, It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, to take off your adult lenses. What do you mean by that, Heather?
Well, I think it's because as adults, you know, we have grown up and sort of forgotten what it's like to be a kid. And we often don't know or have the knowledge of child development, how the human brain grows. And we know scientifically so much more about the value of play and how a child needs direct real-life experiences to gain all these skills. But we're sort of doing the opposite. We've become too adult in our thinking, and we either don't know or have forgotten the good parts of a free and scheduled childhood.
And I know in your book, as you go through these renegade rules, you give us examples of where to take off the adult lenses and why we need to do that. Let's touch on a few of the things you recommend in your book, It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Heather, and the thinking behind them. And first, I want to get right into banning homework in elementary school. Why should there not be homework for elementary grades?
Yes, well, we're finding through the research the academic benefits of homework are highly age-dependent. So it's helpful at the high school level, and then in the middle school level a little bit. But if you look at the research, and this is not just one study, it's a review of 180 different research studies on homework, shows there's zero correlation between the time kids spend on homework and academic achievement in the elementary years.
That is pretty stunning to somebody who came up through, you know, myself doing lots of homework and watch my kids do lots of homework. And I think we all just assume, gosh, that's how they learn.
Right. It must be good for them. I think also with homework, the same studies are finding it's developing negative attitudes towards school. So it's not getting that academic benefit, but it's creating kids who are feeling that they don't like homework, they don't like learning, they don't like school.
Well, I'm wondering, so you've got a child at school, teacher assigns homework, and how does a parent go up the slide and say, no, I don't want my child to do that? I mean, you and your husband have two children. You live in Michigan. How have you applied this in your home?
Our family has banned homework in elementary school, and we have just talked to the teachers individually, in some cases also talked to the principals. But what we're finding is that teachers tend to want parents who are supportive and involved in their child's learning. And so when they found that we were supportive, just supportive in our own philosophy, they were very welcoming on the whole. So that's what we're finding, is that teachers want supportive parents and parents want to support their kids. But there's more than one way to go about this.
I can see, though, logistically how hard it could be to be the fourth grader whose mom has talked to the teacher and said, we don't believe in homework, and other kids are turning in homework, and there has to be some tension there, no?
It depends. We have not found that to be the case. But also homework, there's getting to be a lot more of it, and it's coming at younger and younger ages. So you said, yeah, you had lots of homework as a kid, mm-hmm. and your kids did. Well, it's very typical to have homework now at the kindergarten level. And if there's no homework at the preschool level, a lot of times the parents will complain and ask for it. So there's a sense of fear driving this, that the kids are going to be left behind somehow, and that having the homework will help them catch up with the rest of the world. But instead of having actual homework assignments, something like reading for pleasure at home is much more effective. And another thing that's more effective than homework, and this is all based in the research, is sleep. It's not glamorous, but getting the kids to bed early will improve their memory and learning and focus and their impulse control, so their behavior in the classroom the next day.
I have to ask you about technology, because I love your advice to parents in your book to embrace Amish iPads. What does that mean?
Yes, well, you know, a lot of people think the Amish won't use any technology, but they're actually technology selective. So they look at a piece of technology before just letting it wash over them and decide, how are we going to use this? And are we going to set any restrictions on it so that it helps support values in our family and community? So it's stealing that idea from the Amish and saying, can we somehow look at technology before just accepting it and letting it come however it comes? How can we set some limits on it and make it useful? In other words, use technology. Don't be scared of technology, but put it in its place.
And you also recount in your book your own experience with your son and how you had a really good way of getting your own child to police himself. Tell us how you did that.
Yes, well, the idea is to get the kids to develop some impulse control against the power of the really exciting, enthralling video game. So instead of setting a timer where the whole machine will turn off on its own, it's good to have the child start practicing to have the willpower to turn it off on their own power. So what we did is we asked our child to instead of us as parents coming in saying, you must stop now, because that sets up a icky power struggle between the child and the parent. But allow the child to have that power struggle between themselves and the machine. And it's interesting because then the power struggle dissipates between the parents and child, and the child feels powerful. I'm more powerful than the machine. And we do acknowledge, we say, you know, it can be really tricky to stop these games because they want you to keep playing. And some of the games, really, they send messages to you if you haven't played the game in a while. They're trying all their tactics to get these kids completely sucked in. So just tell the kid, this is a challenge. It's going to be hard for you to turn it off. But if you can show me that you are more powerful than the video game, then you're showing me that you're old enough to play it.
Bullying and mean girl behavior is certainly something our society focuses on. How would your renegade rules attack that? Would it help stop the mean words and bullying, or are they gauged more at making our kids more resilient to whatever mean stuff comes their way, as we know it will?
Right. Well, I think in the past we were all given the advice that sticks and stones, you know, they won't hurt us, with the mean words, all that sort of part. That doesn't really give you any useful tools to deal with mean words. And I think that mean words are really no different than the physical kind of meanness that kids may show to each other, like shoving or pushing or that sort of thing. It's just that when that aggression comes in the form of words, we get less certain of what to do. So we tend to focus on the words themselves, like don't say the word stupid, or, you know, we don't say that word in this house, or that sort of thing. But instead, the mean words are a signal that the child is upset and doesn't like something and doesn't know what to do. And so they're resorting to these mean words. So ignore the word and go directly to the feeling underneath. There's a big emotion driving that behavior. Find out what's going on. There's something you don't like. What is it? What is he doing that you don't like? What is she doing? And find out what that emotion is. And then it's a conflict, just like a shoving and pushing kind of conflict is. Find out how the kids can talk directly about what they don't like and solve the conflict. It's a basic peace skill, conflict mediation. But sometimes we get confused when these mean words pop up and we feel like we don't know how to control them.
You know, Heather, there's such a tension between kind of going along with the way everyone's always done things and something doesn't feel right, we need a change. Where does that boundary line lie and how do we cross it?
Yes, well, I think there's two main ways. One is a lot of adults, parents and others, actually feel something is wrong in their gut. They just feel as if they need to support the system somehow. So trust your gut in some ways. If your gut is telling you that it's wrong when your child has gym class instead of recess 3 days a week, then trust yourself that there is something wrong with that. Or if your child is crying and has stomach aches every day before school, there's something wrong there. So trust yourself there's something wrong going on and listen to that gut. And then dive into some of the research on the topic, because what we know about child development and what we're doing with our kids, the gap is wider than it ever has been before. So the research is showing us that young kids need a lot of play and play through learning, and that they don't need to focus entirely on the cognitive side of their brains, the academic side, that they need a full range of social, emotional, physical learning. So we know that, and yet we're filling their days up with scheduled time and heavy, heavy dose of the cognitive side, all the early academics. So if there's something wrong, listen to your gut and then go dig into what the brain research is telling us, because it's pretty clear that some of our widespread common practices, both in our homes and in our schools, are not what's good and not what's best for kids.
Heather Shoemaker's book is It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. Heather, it was great to talk with you and get your insights. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is engineered by Rusty Brock. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Mercedes Mejia, Daniel Razel, Lindsay Scullin, Kate Summers, and Carl Williams. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.